SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, and welcome to NITV Radio. Betwan Tungandame Ngaya. I'm Betwan Tungandame. Very happy to be your host this Wednesday, September 18. Now, coming up in your program today, we have a conversation with Matthew Karakulakis, owner and founder of AMK Law, a 100 Indigenous-owned legal firm. Matthew joins us to comment on being acknowledged by his peers as the Indigenous Leader of the Year at the Australian Law Awards 2024. Also on NITV Radio today, we'll have Wiradjuri woman, dancer, performance maker and teacher Vicky Van Hoot talking about dance, what it means to her, and sharing her incredible dance journey. Today we also explore the federal government's upcoming laws governing social media access to minors. All these stories and more coming to you on NITV Radio after the news.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
This bulletin, the Australian Federal Police dismantle a global organised crime communications network set up to murder people and traffic drugs. Court allows Indigenous voices in fight to protect Jabiluka from mining lease renewal. And Hezbollah blames Israel as exploding pages kill at least 9 people and injure nearly 3,000 in Lebanon. The accused creator of a secret app used by networks of organized criminals has been arrested after encrypted phones were allegedly used to plot murders and drug trafficking. The Australian Federal Police say the 32-year-old Australian created and maintained the ghost app while living at home with his parents in Sydney and did not have a criminal record. The AFB-led operation also infiltrated a global organized crime communications network which prevented murders and drug deals. 38 people have been arrested after days of raids targeting users of the app. More people are expected to be charged today. AFP Deputy Commissioner Ian McCartney says 700 AFP members carried out more than 70 search warrants across 4 states and the ACT.
We allege hundreds of criminals, including Italian organised crime, motorcycle gang members, Middle Eastern organised crime and Korean organised crime, have used ghosts in Australia and overseas to import illicit drugs and other killings. Up to 50 people in Australia are facing charges and action has been taken by overseas law enforcement agencies to arrest people in their own countries for the use of ghosts. Importantly, the AFP has prevented the death and serious injury of 50 individuals in Australia because we've been able to decrypt these messages.
A judge is allowing the participation of traditional owners in a legal challenge to the cessation of a lease over the Jabiluka uranium mine. The mine is under lease to Energy Resources of Australia, granting the Rio Tinto subsidiary access to the Jabiluka area, which includes an undeveloped uranium deposit estimated to hold 13,700 tons of uranium oxide. Several weeks before the 42-year lease was set to expire in August, the then Northern Territory Labor Mining Minister refused to extend it, partially due to the federal government's plans to extend Kakadu National Park into the area. Energy Resources of Australia is challenging the decision in a federal court, but will now face the traditional owners of the area after it was found the lease detracted from the Mirarr people's rights to access and use the land as they saw fit. It is also being argued that sacred indigenous sites and rock art are found within the area and must be protected. Hundreds of people have rallied in Western Australia to raise awareness about the disappearance of 10 indigenous men in the state. Protesters are calling on the Western Australian government and police for more action and support for resolving the cases. This is the latest event in the Bring Them Home rally movement after similar protests were held in Broome, Geraldton and South Headland at the end of July. This time, they have brought their plea to state parliament, hoping to pressure authorities into more immediate action when an indigenous person goes missing rather than waiting years in some cases before starting the search. The most recent disappearance was 21-year-old Zane Stevens in April this year, but that land search was then later suspended. Speaking to NITV, Barry Taylor says they have been left with no choice but to hold the demonstrations.
Basically, it's been forced upon us by the inaction of the West Australian Police and meeting with government to try and stimulate the investigations for the boys, either, you know, putting up rewards and try and get, you know, people to come forward with information. And it's practically left to us to do these rallies, to do these protests, because we had one in Headland, we had one in Broome, we had one in Geraldton, to try and get some action for these, you know, poor mothers and fathers and that have had their kids missing.
The Productivity Commission says Australian kids should have access to 3 days of free childcare by 2036. Following a review into access and affordability of childcare in Australia, the Commission, which provides independent advice to the government on economic and social issues, made 56 recommendations. It says to achieve universal access to early childhood education and care, there needs to be consistent investment from governments, beginning by focusing on disadvantaged communities. Minister for Education Jason Clare says children from disadvantaged backgrounds are most likely to benefit from the reforms.
This report tells us that it's kids from poor families, kids from the regions, kids with additional needs who are the most likely to benefit from early education and care and currently are the least likely to access it. If we can do something about that that helps more children to start ready for school when they're five, then that would be a significant reform.
Hundreds of handheld pagers have exploded simultaneously across Lebanon and in parts of Syria, killing at least 9 people, including members of the militant group Hezbollah. Officials are blaming Israel in what appears to be a sophisticated remote attack that wounded nearly 3,000 people at a time of rising tensions across the Israeli-Lebanese border. The incident comes at a time of heightened tensions between Lebanon and Israel after a nearly year-long war between Hezbollah ally Hamas and Israel in the Gaza Strip. Lebanon's health minister Firas Abiad confirmed the attack.
At around 3:30 this afternoon, a large number of injuries started flowing into the hospitals. Those injured were primarily hurt after the explosion of communications tools, pages, that they were carrying. The number of people that arrived in the emergency rooms were very large. It was clear that they were from different locations.
The Israeli Defense Force refused to comment. Israeli military analyst Sarit Zehavi says the attack has likely caused a lot of confusion among Hezbollah.
It is definitely an intelligence infiltration that is overwhelming capability. But I think the greatest achievement here is the confusion that it created among Hezbollah, the psychological damage among Hezbollah.
And the United Nations member states have debated a push by Palestinian representatives to to formally demand an end to the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories within 12 months. The text is based around an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice calling Israel's occupation since 1967 unlawful. The draft resolution goes to a vote tomorrow. Israel has firmly rejected the resolution and has fiercely criticized the text. Now back home, the Northern Territory's new government has dismissed calls from a range of groups to reconsider lowering the top end's minimum age of criminal responsibility. Under the previous Labour government, the Northern Territory was the first jurisdiction in the country to raise the age of criminal responsibility in demand with a recommendation by the Royal Commission into the protection and detention of children in the territory. Since the Country Liberal Party was elected to power, a raft of legal, medical and social services experts have raised the alarm on its election promise to lower the age again. New Chief Minister Leah Finocchiaro says she remains resolute in her plan. And to sport, Scotland has come to the rescue of the Commonwealth Games, offering to host the event in 2026. But it will be a stripped-down version funded by Australia. The multi-sport event has been looking for a home after the Victorian government pulled out last year, citing spiralling costs that it said had blown the budget out to $6 billion. Victoria had to pay $380 million in compensation to the Commonwealth Games Federation. $200 million of that figure will be directed to Scotland to cover their hosting costs. And that is to be topped up by $4.5 million from Commonwealth Games Australia to cover security. And now having a look at the weather around the country, this Wednesday afternoon, Broome, a mostly sunny day, 34 degrees, Perth, sunny, 24. Much the same in Adelaide with a top of 22, sunny day and a possible late shower in Melbourne, top of 20, showers in Hobart and a maximum of 15 degrees, sunny day in Albury, Wodonga with a top of 19, also sunny in Canberra with a top of 18, similar conditions in Wollongong with a top of 25, Sydney also sunny, 27, same forecast for Newcastle, the top of 27 as well, and partly cloudy in Brisbane with a top of 25, cloudy day in Townsville, 26 degrees, shower or two in Cairns, 27, Alice Springs, sunny at the top of 28, a shower or two for Darwin, at the top of 32, and in the Torres Strait Islands, a partly cloudy day ahead with a top of 29 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
TV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
In 2025, SBS will offer 3 cadetship positions, including 1 identified placement for an Aboriginal and or Torres Strait Islander candidate, culturally and financially supported by NITV National Indigenous Television. All successful cadets participate in the same program of training and work experience. That was Pillars of Society by the great Kev Carmody. And this song was lifted from the album Pillars of Society. It was so well crafted when it was released, it prompted Rolling Stone magazine to call it arguably the best protest album ever made in Australia. I'm Bertrand Tungandami, and you're listening to NITV Radio, broadcasting from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Wednesday afternoon. Still to come in your program, we have a yarn with a Wiradjuri woman, dancer, performer, and teacher, Vicky Van Hout, talking about dance, what it means to her, and she'll also be sharing her incredible dance journey that has taken her around the world and seen her do some amazing performances. In the conversation that will feature in the program, Vicky also talks about her dance and performing arts workshops in Sydney. Today we also explore the federal government's upcoming laws governing social media access to minors. But first, lawyer Matthew Karakulakis, owner and founder of AMK Law, a 100% Indigenous-owned legal firm, comments on being acknowledged by his peers with yet another prestigious accolade. I'm joined by Matthew Karakulakis, founder and CEO of Indigenous-owned legal firm AMK Law. Matthew is joining us. He's just won the 2024 Leader of the Year Award at the Australian Law Awards. Matthew, first of all, congratulations and welcome to NITV Radio.
Thank you, Bertrand, and hello to you and to all your amazing listeners on NITV Radio.
What does being acknowledged by your peers and being recognized with this prestigious award mean to you?
So winning the award, it means a lot because it's something that goes beyond personal recognition, but instead it highlights the importance of working and supporting First Nations community through the legal frameworks in the work that I do and what we do at AMK Law. It really does give a sense of confidence and affirmation for the work that we're achieving to empower First Nations businesses and our communities and show that it's really making a difference. So it's definitely a strong reminder that every bit of hard work that I do is definitely valued. But beyond this, it's also something that is not really about self, but instead, I think that whenever we're lucky enough to win something or achieve an outcome, it's always built upon the support of our communities, of our ancestors, our elders, and other team members that are there supporting us. So I view that it's really a collective effort, and also I'm motivated to continue striving to achieve great outcomes for First Nations community through this recognition.
Yeah, last year you won the Australasian Award, another very prestigious one, now this time in a wider area, and this year it's the Australian Award. Do you see your work within law as a way of inspiring young First Nations people?
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely see the work that I do as a way of inspiring young First Nations people. I think that's also because there needs to be more First Nations lawyers. And so I hope that through my success, particularly in commercial and dispute resolution laws, that I can show other younger up and coming First Nations lawyers and First Nations people that there is actually a career in law. And it's not just something that's possible, but it can also be incredibly rewarding. And some of the other ways that I do this as well is through mentoring young First Nations students and people as well, and also being able to provide guidance and support. And we also have some programs like the AMK Indigenous Law Students Scholarship that we're doing through Flinders University and the Aboriginal Law Student Mentoring Program that we're also sponsoring. So I think that these are some of the ways that we really do try to help young First Nations people and law students of the future.
Yeah, now you're doing your bit on an individual level and also through your legal firm, but do you feel at times that First Nations people don't get the representation they deserve?
I definitely think that First Nations peoples often don't get the legal representation that's deserved. I think that that creates a real need for First Nations lawyers to better understand and represent First Nations people. So that's why, one of the reasons why it's important, I believe, that we have more First Nations lawyers. Some of the challenges obviously come through things like the cultural disconnection. So the legal system in Australia, because it's based on Western principles, it's often not aligned with First Nations ways of doing things. And so to be able to have the connection through the sorts of understandings, I believe that there needs to be that cultural place of connection to properly represent First Nations peoples. And there's obviously some significant issues about access to legal representation that First Nations people in communities have suffered from for many years, including remote and regional areas. And some of these issues have gone into, you know, the great overrepresentation in the criminal justice system of First Nations peoples. And some of these include the much higher and disproportionate incarceration rates of arrest and racial division that occurs and is inflicted upon First Nations peoples amongst those that have been incarcerated, especially when you compare this against non-Indigenous Australians. I think these are some of the reasons, Bertram, but there's definitely a lot more that we could go into in terms of the representation issues that First Nations peoples really do deserve.
As an Indigenous-owned legal firm, how does AMK Law assist First Nations clients and the community?
Yeah, so I personally work to assist First Nations clients and community in a number of ways, but first and foremost by providing culturally appropriate legal advice, by really understanding and connecting when providing legal services in a way that understands, identifies, connects with, and empowers the unique needs of First Nations communities and our clients as well. Some of the other parts of that assisting community are about the mentoring program, the advocacy work, and something else that I also work on is the Battle Against Black Cladding Masterclass, which raises awareness and provides frameworks for getting the necessary changes in place amongst and really to benefit proper Aboriginal business outcomes for Aboriginal businesses and for procurement teams to be able to see better outcomes through the vehicle of business, going into Aboriginal communities and empowering some of those changes that need to happen when you look at the closing the gap type metrics. We also have the Black Excellence in Governance Being program that David Mayo and I created, and it's specifically designed for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander boards and organisations where cultural aspects are really understood and strong governance practices take place through and as a result of the Being program to help in that governance space for Aboriginal community organisations.
Yeah, you just mentioned black cladding. This is a topic we've covered so many times on this program, and it's something you've been really working on tirelessly over the years. Now, are there any recent changes for the better in when it comes to black cladding?
Yeah, I'd say that when it comes to black cladding, there is some awareness that's beginning to improve. There's still a long way to go, Bertram. I think that there was a positive aspect of a recent case and court decision involving GLAD Holdings where the term black cladding was specifically referred to in the court of the judgment, which is a good step forward. I think that when you get a statement of legal judgment, then referring to a new concept, that can then step into frameworks of creating law, which is great. I believe that the awareness piece is definitely continuing to improve. And through my battle against Black Cladding Masterclass, we've started to get some really good outcomes, not only in awareness, but also in creating the frameworks for the changes that need to happen when it comes to working with Aboriginal businesses. There was also some awareness a few weeks ago in the SBS NITV episode that was with Carla Grant on her Living Black program that specifically raised awareness on black cladding issues. And so I think that the most positive recent change in the black cladding area really is about the awareness that's taking place and some of the frameworks that are developing.
Yeah, no, definitely this TV program had a great impact and a lot of following, just like your masterclasses and your podcast as well, because you also run a podcast where you raise this awareness. Now, Matthew, before I let you go, anything you'd like to add to the conversation we haven't covered that's really crucial for our listeners?
Yeah, I guess the only thing to really add is I've given a bit of a positive touch into some of the changes in awareness around black cladding, but obviously that still is a very significant issue. And the more people that we have that want to see Aboriginal business being done right, and the more people that we have that want to be working with and empowering Aboriginal communities, whether that's through the law or whatever area of work we are in, I think the more that we can have together as Aboriginal peoples and our allies, the stronger and better the future is likely to be.
Yeah, Matthew Karakalakis, founder and CEO of AMK Law and winner of the Leader of the Year Award at the Australian Law Awards 2024. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us on NITV Radio today.
Thank you, and wonderful catching up with you again, Bedrin.
We must now step aside for a short break, but don't go away, because when we come back, we hear the extraordinary journey of Vicky Van Hout, a dancer, performer, and choreographer.
NITV Radio, on radio, online, and mobile.
Make sure you get the full picture, not just what the social media feed gives you. Find all our news and stories at SBS Language website. Bookmark sbs.com.au/language in your web browser today.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio, coming to you from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Wednesday afternoon. Still to come, Vicky Van Hout, an Indigenous independent choreographer, performance maker and teacher who has worked across a range of performance media nationally and internationally, shares the story of her journey, a really extraordinary one, with NITV Radio's Sharka Pekova. But first, Lady Blue by Emily Waramara.
Local and global leadership across First Nations practice, contemporary dance and physical theatre will head to Sydney in August and September. For 4 weeks, IDEA 24, Independent Dance Exchange Australia, will feature public performances, workshops and seminars. And one workshop will be also led by Vicky Van Hout. Virtual woman Vicky Van Hout is a performance maker, a teacher who is leading a six-day workshop for both First Nations and non-Indigenous dancers in Sydney. Vicky was the first Australian Indigenous dancer to graduate from Martha Graham School of Contemporary Dance in New York. She then returned home to Bangarra Dance Theatre for their overseas tour. Vicky has won many awards for her work and is one of 50 art workers chosen to contribute to a book celebrating the Sydney Opera House 50th anniversary. And Vicky is now joining us on NITV Radio. Hello and welcome, Vicky.
Oh, hello.
Vicky, can you please tell us a bit more first about yourself, who your people are, and also what was your journey to dance?
So I'm Wiradjuri. That's on my mother's side and my grandmother's side. And I think I'm a bit of everything, because I found out a little while ago that my grandmother's father was from Afghanistan.
Oh.
And yeah, I know. And then on my mother's side also, my grandfather, I think maybe he's from Scotland, but on my father's side, from Holland. So like many Indigenous people, I have a diverse background and I'm a cultural melting pot in one. My dance practice actually started in the front yard of our house in Dapto. I lived on 49 Bamboo Crescent in Coonawarra in Dapto. And what I would do is I would try to entice or enlist all my friends and my relatives who were around about the same age as me, and we would dance in the front yard. We had no front fence. So whoever went past, they were the captive or non-captive audience. So that's when my passion for dance began. But then along the way, I got into acting. I auditioned for NIDA when I was very young. I don't think I'd finished high school, and they said, go off and finish high school. But somebody else said, NIDA, why do you want to go to NIDA? Why don't you go to NASDA? I said, what the hell is NASDA? And they said, well, that's a place where you can you can learn to dance, but you can learn about your own people. So armed with my solos from my audition at NIDA, I auditioned for NASDA, and it was grueling. And from that, Ernie Dingo invited me to take part in the first Black Playwrights Conference in Canberra in 1987, I think. And, you know, I was rubbing shoulders with Ujiru Noonuckle, Bob Mazza, you know, Rhoda Roberts, Lydia Miller, Justine Saunders, all the people who were, you know, a part of the vibrant kind of beginnings of black theatre in Redfern and in Australia. So, you know, I took part in that, and then I found out I got accepted into NASDA, and then Ernie said, oh, why don't you be a part of this play that's coming up? And I said, oh, no, now, Ernie, I'm going to be a dancer. And I think I had 100% attendance, and a fellow called Paul Saliba, he said, I think you should go to Martha Graham. And so then in my fourth year, I was trucked off, flew to Martha Graham, came back at the behest of Stephen Page. And so I danced at Bankara, but I knew that the work I wanted to make was a little bit more off the wall, and I knew I wanted to be the author of my own works and maybe not a dancer. I still love dance, but I love making dance, you know, and I love being a part of the murky process that is synthesizing and creating, and, you know, we're butting heads and coming up with crazy ideas. And so, yeah, that's how I got into dance. Sorry, that was longer than necessary.
No, it's a beautiful journey. And you've danced at these various projects and trained in New York, done your own pieces. What do you think was pivotal for your dance career, or creative career, I should say?
I always like to think that the greatest event of my career is yet to come. But, you know, when you were talking about the Opera House and the 50th anniversary and 50 of us being chosen, that was an honour. And so I was in a work with legs on the wall called Saw, and I was suspended 20 metres in the air, hanging from a crane on top of a big block of ice that was 2.4 or 2.7 tonnes, and it slowly melted. I think I also slowly melted. So that was the Sydney Festival 2019, maybe 2020? Yeah, but that was crazy. Also dancing, I can say, also dancing the day before Sorry Day in 2007 as part of the opening, I think it was the first Indigenous Welcome to Country in Parliament. That also was a big honour. So I think dance has given me a lot of opportunities. I've seen the world, but, you know, I think the dance that, you know, the dance that I do, or the dance that I love the most, are all that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander dances that people have taught me. It just is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to learn dances and songs that have an unbroken lineage, that have existed or have been passed down to people since before the time of English settlement. So I, in that respect, I'm very lucky, and I know that it's my dream that one day we'll, you know, we'll be in a lovely position that everybody will do it. In that respect, I'm a bit jealous of the people in New Zealand, in Aotearoa, because everybody sings Waiata. Whether you're Māori or Pākehā, everybody sings Waiata. And, you know, you see the All Blacks, and they are Māori and Pākehā together, and they all do the haka. And I wish that one day we'll be in a situation where non-Indigenous and Indigenous people, we won't feel the urgency and the criticality of our situation, and we'll be, you know, we'll be more inclined to release those things to other people. So when I do these workshops, it's kind of a sharing of that perspective. So the idea for me, it's an opportunity. Idea is an opportunity to how our bodies are repositories, are libraries, how our bodies are also the arbiters of law, and how our busy hands and speak country, how bare feet in contact with the earth summon ancestors to witness our practices, to find ways to discuss what's important to us and also what's not important, what there is to celebrate and what is frivolous, and to make those things a part of the dreaming canon, you know, for Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. I foresee a day where Indigenous and non-Indigenous people will have a hand in the dreaming canon and will join in. Yes.
You kind of answered my next question by this, but what can people expect when they will be attending your six-day workshop for the IDEA 24?
Well, we will be looking at how we tell stories as Aboriginal people, so generating narratives, chronicling things, and we will look at what it means to be an Aboriginal person as a part of the fabric of the universe, rather than man as the apex of something. So to give maybe a chair some animation, we'll look at some of the dance vocabularies that have excited me and to see how they can be merged with vocabularies of other people and to make new languages. So I'll lead a workshop in the morning using various Aboriginal ways of moving, you know, locomotion, so how we place our foot to the floor, the way we gesture, the way we hold our bodies, and then look at how to juxtapose that against Western contemporary movement. Then I'll also look at, hopefully, I want to look at the different crafting and how that can be a tool for choreography. So they're just two of the things that I can think of offhand, but it's really seeing how, like, an Aboriginal, not just an Aboriginal way of moving, but an Aboriginal way of thinking can help other young makers and dancers create their own pieces, so that it's not just something that I dance and I go, oh, you've had a little moment with this, but how they can hopefully go away with some tools, some choreographic tools and some movement languages, some Indigenous contemporary kind of languages that they can go away and they can, you know, feel comfortable enough to utilise in their dances as well. I've got a maybe, some would say crass, some would say wicked. I have a predilection towards humour, so it could be wicked humour, it could be bad humour, crass humour. I think there's something about, you know, blackfella storytelling or blackfella ways of being, that there will always be a time for laughter. So we're going to be hard at work playing.
That's awesome. Vicky, who can join your workshop?
You know what? Anybody who's willing. You just need to, you know, be prepared to dance in bare feet, so to take your shoes off. And, you know, if you can move around. What I love the most about dancing in community is that the very youngest and the very oldest dance. That you have the people who are, you know, leaders and they've got a physical virtuosity, and you've got people who don't dance all the time. I would like to think that the workshops that I offer will be a challenge for both the professional, you know, contemporary dancer or dancer of other genres, and people who have maybe an enjoyment for dance and who would like to be challenged in that respect. So I'm trying to leave it open. So if you feel like that's you, if they feel like that's them and they, you know, you want to give it a go, that's the person I want to attract.
It sounds to me you're very passionate about movement, and I don't know how our listeners, but whenever I hear dance, it always comes to my mind. It's very elite, you know, you have to start when you're little and then really train hard, and maybe when you're 20, 30, you retire. But from what I hear from you, it sounds it's very inclusive.
It is very inclusive, and I've got to say I'm an anomaly there, because I did, you know, really training later. So I started really training maybe when I was about 16, 17, and then I was training full-time at NASDA and then full-time at Martha Graham. But I'm 56, I'm still dancing. I'm dancing more now than I was when I was in my 30s. I think we need to smash those funny notions that dance is for the few. Dance is for everyone.
NITV Radio, on radio, online and mobile.
And that was dancer and choreographer Vicky Van Hout sharing her story, extraordinary story, journey as a dancer with NITV Radio's Sharka Pekova. We must now step aside for another break, but stay with us. When we come back, we explore the federal government's proposed laws governing youth access to social media.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Welcome back. Now, the federal government says legislation enforcing a minimum age for social media use will be introduced by the end of the year. But some experts are raising concerns that this will not solve any problems and is the wrong approach to the issue. Samdova reports.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is trumpeting a new proposal to raise the minimum age that minors can access social media platforms from in Australia, saying this will be enforced with new technology.
Social media can cause social harm. What we want to see, what I want to see and what parents want to see, is them off their devices and onto the footy field or the netball courts, or in the swimming pool or the tennis court, but engaging with real people and having those real experiences.
And while most experts acknowledge that platforms like Facebook, Instagram and TikTok present a new frontier that can negatively impact the mental health of young Australians, some aren't quite convinced that the government's proposal will help. Dr. Rhys Farthing, Policy Director at Reset Tech Australia, says the risks of harm from social media use are real, but banning young people from accessing it won't fix the underlying issues.
On principle, anything that protects children and young people is good, and we've got to do it. But the real question is here, is this the best way to protect children and young people, and will this be effective?
The law would put Australia among the first countries in the world to enforce an age restriction on social media. Previous attempts, including by the European Union, have largely failed or found enforcement challenging. Dr. Farthing says some may see it as a leaping-off point, but she's not convinced it will meaningfully protect kids.
There's a world in which it's a like, yes, and. It's like, yes, and make the platforms be safe. I don't even feel that way about it. I sort of feel like it's more like an okay, sure, and. I just don't think, given the difficulties in implementation and given that it's actually just going to end up resting on parental consent most likely, I don't think it's going to make that much of a difference, even in conjunction with comprehensive regulation. I'd love to be proven wrong, though.
These challenges in implementation were highlighted by Australia's eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inman-Grant, who, at a parliamentary inquiry in June, said she supports age verification for these platforms but believes we don't yet know if the technology is effective.
eSafety has long advocated for age verification as part of a suite of measures to protect children from online content and conduct they are not ready for. But until these comprehensive age assurance systems are in place, implementation of social media age bans will be challenging to measure, implement, and enforce.
She also warned that restriction-based approaches may limit young people's access to critical support networks. The government's proposed restrictions would not come into effect until they're able to determine the efficacy of age assurance technology. The government's $6.5 million trial into the technology is set to finish at the end of the 2024-2025 financial year, which means any law would likely not be introduced until after next year's federal election, which is rumoured to take place in May. Mr. Albanese is yet to specify the age that young people would be able to access social media from under the law, but says it would likely be between 14 and 16. Dr. Simon Wilksch, a senior research fellow at Flinders University and an eating disorder clinician, says he's happy to hear the government's proposal and would like to see the age limit raised from 13 to 16.
I'm a strong advocate for raising the minimum age to 16. I come at this issue as a clinical psychologist providing treatment to children, adolescents and adults experiencing an eating disorder. There's research that tells us that since social media has come in, there's been a massive spike over the last 12 years. Now, we're not trying to say that social media is the single cause of that, but it has certainly played an important role. And I hear about that in the therapy room with parents who are tearing their hair out trying to deal with this issue. So I am of the view that the later the better when it comes to access for social media. And I'm genuinely encouraged by the announcement of looking to increase minimum age.
The data he refers to here comes from Deloitte's Paying the Price reports from 2012 and 2024, which shows approximately a 200% increase in the number of children aged from 10 to 14 years old with an eating disorder in Australia. He also highlights a 2023 review of 50 studies in 17 countries that indicated that social media usage leads to body image concerns, eating disorders, and poor mental health via the mediating pathways of social comparison, thin-fit ideal internalization, and self-objectification. The federal government's proposal follows a similar one from South Australian Premier Peter Malinauskas. His state government responded to a report authored by former Chief Justice of Australia Robert French on the potential harms social media brings to young Australians. Their proposed law will look to have 14 and 15-year-olds banned from social media unless parental consent is given, with those aged 16 and up able to access it freely. Dr. Wilksch has criticised this approach, saying there should be a blanket ban until 16 to reduce social pressures.
My one concern with that is that I think it will put parents in a difficult position with the 14 and 15-year-olds. I think some parents will, of course, prefer their child not to be on social media. Others might not be as informed and will allow their child to be on it. So it will still set up difficulties for schools and social situations with teenagers at school where some are on it and some are not. I would prefer one blanket system across the whole country. And from what I know of the research and my experience helping people, 16 makes the most sense to me.
But some of this conversation misses the profound benefits many young people have reported with social media access, especially those who are marginalised. Dr. Farthing of Reset Tech Australia says young people often paint a much more nuanced picture.
When you talk to children and young people, they give you the same sort of mixed insights as the research finds. They will talk about, yeah, look, there are these aspects of social media that, gosh, I don't like them. They don't feel good. I don't feel great about them. But then they also tell us things about accessing social media that's really useful for them and that's really helpful for them in all of the ways that we're concerned about, whether it's access to education, whether it's access to support around mental health and guidance and these sorts of things. And the approach of just removing young people from it feels a little bit blunt and not quite nuanced enough.
And while countries in Europe have found it difficult to enforce social media age restrictions, Dr. Farthing praises the European Union's Digital Services Act for putting pressure on corporations to clean up their platforms for young people. She says this kind of nuanced legislation should be the way forward for Australia.
So if you look at what Europe is doing, for example, with the Digital Services Act, they've implemented a whole host of reforms that require platforms to mitigate against all sorts of risks to minors. So risks that happen to minors because of harmful content, risks that happen to minors because of targeting ads at them, risks that happen to minors because of inappropriate data collection and data use, risks that happen to minors because platforms introduce them to stranger adults. We see platforms changing and we see safety standards increasing in Europe, and European children enjoy those safety protections, but we don't have them in Australia.
Sam Dover, SBS News.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
And that's all from us on NITV Radio this Wednesday afternoon. Your program will be back on Friday with more news and stories from right across the country. I'm Bertrand Tungandame, thanking you for being with me this Wednesday afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Yalu, leaving you with 2000 and Something by Kite.
Had no friends, so I had to sit with him. Now I can quit it.